me for this week's Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in." And you're not only in, but in at the best program for you. The topic of graduate admissions is incredibly broad, encompassing academic degrees, the therapies, professional programs like the MD, JD, and PsyD, and everything in between, and probably much, much, much more. Today, I'm going to interview the former dean of graduate admissions for Hofstra University, who on one hand has processed thousands of graduate school applications, and on the other hand has a 30,000-foot perspective on the application process and what you, as an applicant, should be doing. But first, I'd like to remind you that if you have an admissions-related question that you would like me to address, just go to the show notes at info.accepted.com/113 and ask your question in a comment on the blog. We're developing a wonderful and thoughtful community on Accepted, so feel free to comment there. And rather than respond to a specific question at this point, I'm going to respond to a genre of questions that I'm getting in a variety of formats and forums, email, phone, whatever, email, phone, forums, all kinds of places, LinkedIn. And the question goes something along these lines. It's, I think, best described as, can element X keep me out? Is element X an automatic rejection? Is it a deal stopper, deal breaker? Whatever element X is. And it can be a low test score, a low GPA, certain other deficiencies can mean rejection at certain schools and certain times. And there are definitely cases, there's no question, where a very low test score, a very low GPA, or certain other deficiencies can mean rejection at specific schools and at specific points in time. However, in most cases, that element X is going to be evaluated in both the context of your entire application and the applicant pool in which you are submitting your application. And in most categories, in most cases, I can't categorically say that element X is going to be a deal breaker. There are some times when, yes, I can. But most cases, I can't. And I also can't usually say what you really want to hear, what the questioner really wants to hear, which is, oh, element X won't matter at all. You can kind of wave it away. In today's era of holistic admissions, while the numbers and the objective criteria still count, in many, many cases, it's up to you to make a strong case why a school should overlook element X and admit you because of your many other strengths and achievements. So the more competitive the school, the more important that strong case becomes. And the other element, the other reality you have to consider is that element X may be a deal breaker at certain schools. It may be a deal breaker at certain points in time, but there probably are other schools or programs where element X will not be a reason for a rejection, an automatic reason for rejection. And now to our guest. I'm delighted to have Carol Drummer, Accepted Consultant and former Dean for Graduate Admissions at Hofstra University, join me on Admission Straight Talk. During the 10 years that she served as Dean of Graduate Admissions, she reviewed and signed off on 4,500 applications per year. That's a total of 45,000 applications in the course of those 10 years. Prior to becoming Dean of Graduate Admissions, she served as Senior Assistant Dean for Hofstra's School of Communications for 6 years. She also has taught communications at Hofstra since 1991. She's a master's in education with special honors in communications and a bachelor's in speech, arts, and sciences, both from Queens College. Throughout her career, Carol has advised thousands of prospective MBA, PhD, MFA, MA and MS, and pre-med post-bac students through the application process, helping them to choose the schools that fit them, prepare for the GMAT and GRE exams, develop engaging statements of purpose, and role play for that critical admissions interview. We're going to talk to her today and hear, tap into her wisdom and experience. Carol, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure having you. How did you get into the whole graduate admissions end of education at Hofstra?
Actually, it's an interesting story, and it's a very non-traditional route that I took into graduate admissions. I was serving, as you mentioned, as the senior assistant dean in the School of Communication.
Yeah.
And in that role, I was advising undergraduate students. I was helping students find career paths after graduation, getting them into internships, working in external relations, getting people to give scholarship monies for our undergraduate students. And just one interesting fall day, I was at the wine and cheese party that they had for faculty and staff. And as I was going around talking to all the faculty, were, you know, very good friends of mine, and just having a very nice social event, I noticed across the room that the president of the university and the senior executive vice president were together and talking and looking at me and actually watching me wander about the room and meet up with different faculty. And
that
I thought,
that must make you very uncomfortable.
It did. As a matter of fact, I said, well, I'm either in a whole lot of trouble or I did something right, and I wasn't quite sure which it was. And so I just, you know, chalked it up. I said, well, perhaps it wasn't, they weren't looking at me, or perhaps they were just pleased with my work, and I'd like to think the positive. I always do. So I made the assumption that they were just pleased with my work. And it was, I think, the next day or the day after that, I got a call asking for me to come in. And the senior executive vice president, who was also the provost, said to me, we'd like to make you an offer. You know, we think that you would be an extraordinary good fit to be the dean of graduate admissions, and we would like to offer you that position.
Pretty good.
Well, I was completely taken aback. I went, what? You know, it just came out of left field. And then everything started to click in, and I said, oh, maybe that's what was going on at that wine and cheese party. Maybe I eat cheese and drink wine really well. You know, I really don't know. Somehow I got their interest at that event. So I said, well, you know, can I think about it? And as is always the case in academia, they said, yes, you have the weekend. Get your answer on Monday. And I said, oh, thank you. And, of course, I went in on Monday and spoke with them, and I said, I've not done this before. I want you to understand that there may very well be a learning curve, but I would be excited and pleased to accept the offer, and I can't wait to start.
Great. And,
you know, it was just a wonderful kind of experience. And, you know, when I inherited the position, the people prior to me were not necessarily people kind of, administrators, and I had to kind of reinvent it in a way that would make me comfortable. And that means meeting with students on a regular basis, inviting them in, talking to them, doing seminars and workshops with them, helping them through the process, helping them find the right answers for them, and speaking at large meetings of, you know, open houses and info sessions and so on. And I actually love that part of it so much. Mm-hmm. That was the part that I loved the best, you know, was that kind of engaging with students and helping them meet with success. I felt that I was really serving them in a lot of different ways. And so that was the piece of the job that I loved best. Of course, I had to do a lot of other parts of it as well. Sometimes I had to be faced with their tears when they were not accepted, and, you know, try to give them some kind of feedback about what may have gone wrong.
Sure.
In the process. And I did review and, make decisions on, I can't believe when you shared that, you know, 45,000 applications over the 10 years that I was there. Wow. I was even impressed with me. So I thought that was pretty great. But it was, you know, really great. And that's also what I love that I'm doing now with Accepted.com is working with students. Helping them find their way, find a path that works for them. It's very rewarding.
That is, I think, the most exciting part of our work. Absolutely, I agree with you. Now, you wrote a wonderful piece for Accepted's blog called Is Graduate School for You? Can you summarize the critical steps you outlined there in determining if it's for you? And I'll link to it also from info.accepted.com/113, since this is the 113th episode.
Okay. Yeah, I wrote that that blog because I was faced with that question over and over again from undergraduate students that were getting ready to graduate, or some of them even in their junior year. And and in fact, I ran some workshops and seminars at Hofstra University on that very issue for groups of students. Not just at Hofstra, but I invited anybody who anywhere that wanted to come and take part in that. And so I came up with a strategy that appears to be work and be successful. And that is that the best way to learn something or a problem solve, I believe, is to know what are the right questions. Okay. If you know the right questions, you'll find the answers that are right for you. And it's not the same answers for every student. So I came up with four basic questions that I would suggest students pose to themselves in order to come to some understanding about whether or not grad school was the right choice for them. And the questions, you know, pretty much were, question one might be, what are your short and long-term goals and objectives? Mm-hmm. Question two would be, will graduate school help you fill those goals and objectives? Three is now the right time to do this? And four is, what are the benefits and the costs of pursuing an advanced degree?
Right.
Then I would share with students that they should use what I developed as kind of my own little, you know, brand of using the three E's of brainstorming, which I call explore, examine, and evaluate. And I said, if you ask each of those questions, and for each of those questions, you explore the possibilities, you examine the possibilities, and then you evaluate the possibilities, that will help you successfully make an informed decision about your own future.
Can you clarify what's the difference between explore and, I mean, evaluate I get, but between explore and examine?
They're closely aligned. It's kind of the whole thing that when you talk about brainstorming, and I teach that in my interpersonal communications classes as well, you're talking about, at the very first step, quantity, not quality.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than make a critical evaluation, like come up with an idea and say, oh, that's not good, don't do that. Just make a list, whether you physically write the list or you mentally make a list, of everything that comes to your mind. That's how you explore. Just put them all down there, all right? Once you have this whole long, either mental or physical list, you know, written list.
That's the storm and brainstorm, isn't it?
Yep, that's the storm and brainstorming. Yes, thank you. I like that. Then once you do that, before you start to evaluate it, I put an extra E in there, which is examine it. Make sure that everything, you have everything there. Did you miss something? Would you like to change something slightly? Would you like to eliminate something from that list because it's really not relevant when you look back at it? And then once you do that, and again, it does not, you know, these are very overlapping steps, by the way, then you get to the point where now you're ready to evaluate and come to terms and prioritize. What do you think is the most relevant answer to this question? Or answers, because sometimes it can be more than one. So you really, in the process of doing this, you really learn a lot about yourself that you might not have known before. And if you use this three-step process of brainstorming, you know, most of the time when you do brainstorming, you just throw out all the ideas, then kind of organize them, and then evaluate which are the best ones. That's what I would suggest students do.
Right. And those three steps, of course, are exactly what you said, explore, examine, evaluate. You know, you did it in three E's, which makes it easier to remember.
Yeah, I just kind of like the way that
is. Yeah, that's good.
The alliteration.
Good. Right. Right, absolutely.
And, you know, it's what I share with students even in my classes.
Sure.
You know, you need to, I'm not going to just give you answers when I teach you a class.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to encourage you to ask the right questions, and you find the answers.
Right.
And if you do that, you will be a lifelong learner, which is something I've always done. There's never a time when I don't ask myself, but then when I'm looking at something or research something, that I don't come up with a whole list of questions that come into my mind. And the process of finding the answers is the fun part. That's the creative part.
It's true. That is very creative. Now, there are so many specialties in terms of graduate studies. There are so many degree choices. There are so many institutions offering degree online, offline, you know, state universities, private schools, different specialties, professional degrees, more academic programs. What can you, at a very high level, and I realize it has to be high level just because there's so much there, what are some of the differences among different graduate specialties? You have, you know, the therapies, the STEM fields, academic fields, in terms of maybe who should go into different directions probably is too hard, but in terms of what they're looking for in the graduate application, what are the commonalities, what are some of the distinctions?
Those were some of the very things that I learned in that learning curve that I talked to you about earlier. Yes, is that there are so many different programs, and they're all so different. There are some commonalities between certain programs, but, you know, part of what, applicants should be looking at is doing the research on all of the different specialties and understanding what those differences are. So, for example, you know, there are programs that will only take you post-master's. All right?
Right.
Not that many, however, though. Most PhD programs that I've come in contact with over my years, my 10 years in graduate admissions, are those that want you to earn the master's en route to the PhD. They may take a few people who have already earned their master's, but not very many, and some none at all.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to know that in terms of who you are, in fact, competing with, if that's the case, when you're applying to a program. Are you the lone person who is just, post-baccalaureate and has not earned a master's, or are there a lot of people that are applying and might be given more credibility, perhaps, because they already earned their master's? So that will vary from program to program. You know, we had a clinical psychology program at Hofstra, and for the most part, they took only people who had not yet earned a master's degree. They wanted to be the people that educated them, and they would earn their master's degree en route. We had a PsyD program, a doctor of psychology program, that would take both. But they had a limited number of seats for those who were post-masters.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kinds of things that are, you know, are different. Most, for example, speech and language pathology programs, that when they look at the criteria and they're evaluating you, some of them are more interested, for example, in your GPA in your major than they are in the GPA overall. Now, they want you to have a high GPA overall, but they look very, very carefully and weight it very carefully what the GPA was in your major. How well did you do in those courses, like anatomy and physiology of the speech mechanism, for example? Mm-hmm. What did you earn in that class? Because that's kind of a gateway, in terms of if you did really well in that class, that speaks very well towards your, candidacy for a master's in speech language pathology. So you have that kind of, a situation. There are some, as you well know, Linda, there are some MBA programs that only want people who have 2 years or more experience.
Right, many.
Or they
most.
most, right. Or they may have two different programs for the two different populations. Mm-hmm. So you need to know what program you're applying to and whether you fit the parameters of that, rather than find out later, get denied and not, even realize it was because you're not appropriate for that program and shouldn't have applied in the first place. So that's some of the kinds of considerations. Some of them are, for example, very interested in where you went as an undergraduate, not necessarily in terms of whether it's a very renowned institution, but how the coursework was taught that you are going to be pursuing on the graduate level.
What do you mean?
I'll give you an example, because I think that's the best way to explain it, which shocked me. I was working with the faculty committee for the PhD program in clinical psychology at Hofstra, and they were going through all of the candidates. There was one candidate that they passed on, and I could not understand why. This was a candidate who had a 4.0 from a prestigious university, had earned, I think, 780 on the subject test, the psychology subject test, GRE, which is a very high score.
Sure.
everything on paper looked amazing. And I went to the faculty committee and I said, what did this student do wrong? I can't understand. I need to understand this, because if I'm advising students, I need to know what to tell them. And I was actually rather shocked when they said they studied the kind of psychology that we don't practice here. And I said, what? And they said, we are a behavioral modification program in psychology. And they went to a school that was Freudian-based psychology.
Yeah, yeah.
And so more they therapy. Would not be a good fit for our program, no matter how prestigious, you know, their application is or how strong it is. And it was something that I learned as well. And then they also look for things like, have you done research?
Sure.
Who have you done research with? Have you presented, you know, done abstracts and presented at professional, you know, kinds of organizations? And so when students will say, well, how do I get in? It's not always just about the GPA and if they have taken the GRE or GMAT, the GMAT score. There's so much more involved
right.
in terms of how they make those decisions.
Showing fit.
Yeah, yeah. I can understand that. Provosts want to have to choose the students that will be the best fit for them.
Right. Now, let's look at the application process a little bit more from not so much you helping applicants get in or even learning the ropes of your job from 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. How, as an evaluator of applications, what made an application come alive for you? Especially once you did learn the ropes, and tell you this applicant is going to be a great fit for this program in Hofstra University.
When I would look at that, I would look beyond just their scores and their GPAs. I looked at that because in some programs they wouldn't even be considered if they didn't meet the minimum.
Sure.
But I looked well beyond that because there are many cases where people who didn't meet the minimum were actually accepted to the program. And it was because their applications had this kind of special authentic voice. I knew this person by reading their full application. I felt that I had met them.
Yeah.
They just, their passion, who they were, I could almost like draw a mental picture of who they were in my mind, because there was something about their application that was not just a compilation of here's my resume, here's my statement, here's my GRE scores, here's my GMAT score, whichever, here's my GPA. There was something more. There was a humanity there. I can't really find quite the right words that I said, wow, I feel like I know you. And not only do I feel like I know you, I feel like I would like to know you better.
Yeah, that's the real goal.
Yeah. And I had a student who actually applied for the post-bac pre-med program at Hofstra, and I was making the decisions on those programs, who did not meet any of the criteria that we had set up as a committee and that I was making the decisions on. And the GPA did not meet the GPA. The student had tried to take some of these courses before and did poorly. And did not go necessarily to a school where I can say, well, this was a very prestigious school, so maybe the GPA, you know, is really higher, you know, than if they had gone somewhere else.
Yeah.
Didn't meet any of that. But they wrote an essay that was so heartfelt about how much they wanted this and how they knew they didn't meet the criteria and what they were doing about it, and how they wished that somebody would just give them a chance to try, that I accepted them. I mean, I went to the faculty, and I said, I want to accept this student, and I know they meet none of the criteria. But something about what they said felt so real to me, so heartfelt. It wasn't, a sample essay. It wasn't something scripted. This was the young woman's true feelings, and it just made me want to give her that chance. And they went right along with me. They said, absolutely.
Did she do well? Do you know if she did well when she got in?
Yeah, she did very well. And she came to see me all the time.
That's
she said,
nice.
You gave me this chance. I said, stop saying thank you. I said, you've earned it now. You don't need to thank me anymore. You've earned it. Yeah, she did very well.
What really killed an application for you?
What kills an application for me is when it's just that, an application, that nothing stands out, that I don't feel that this person has taken the time and the effort to know who we are as a program. All right, that's very, very important. And that they have given me nothing. You know, I almost want to feel, if I could, to shake them and say, give me something I can work with here. You know, they've given me nothing. They have, you know, a statement of purpose that is just that, you know, it's kind of like a chronology. They don't tell me any stories. You know, that's so important.
Sure.
Tell me a story about yourself. Tell me who you are. Give me a humorous anecdote or something that, you know, an embarrassing anecdote, which, you know, because then I see you. If they don't give me that, you know, and they don't know who we are as a program, that would kill an application.
I've interviewed several times admissions directors for different kinds of programs, you know, medical school, MBA programs, whatever. And one of the questions I like to ask is, whom would you like to meet in the application? And almost always, the person on the other end gets kind of excited about, just I think about the concept of meeting somebody via the application. They know that they like the question because mm-hmm. it's not so much what should be in there, it's whom would you like to meet? And the answer almost is, I'd like to meet a real person.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, maybe without warts, but yes. but a real person.
Yeah, without warts is good too. Yeah, without warts. But the one thing you want to take care, I think, and I don't think many students do this, at least none that I've worked with, is to sound too arrogant either.
Oh, absolutely. That's you know, the kiss of death.
So a wart or two isn't bad as long as you can spin it in a positive way.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I think arrogance would probably be the ultimate wart.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm not talking here about failures or occasional failure or something that you learn from, something where you can show resilience. That's not a wart. A wart would be, a very bad one, would be arrogance, actually.
Yes, I agree.
How would you recommend that applicants approach the statement of purpose, which clearly is a focus of yours in evaluating applications?
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell them to try to put themselves in the person who's going to be receiving this position and say, you know, or put themselves in the position. What would you want to know about somebody? What would impact you? You know, what would you like to share about yourself? And then I tell them not to sit there with either their keyboard in hand or a pencil or pen if they were a little bit more old-fashioned, and stress over it and try to make it perfect in the first writing.
Right.
That's not the way to do it. I almost like something I call and have called when I work with students in rhetoric classes, free writing. Just write. Just kind of like, I don't know, just let it out. Just write and write and write and write, and when you're done, when you say, oh, I wrote so much, then go back and look at what you wrote. And the things that will matter will come at you. And it's what I do, as a matter of fact, as a writer. I just, you know, I don't sit there and start writing it perfectly because that will probably, you know, put me into writer's block. You know, I'll say, oh, I don't know how to make this perfect. No, I don't try to make it perfect. I just write everything I can think of. It's kind of like the brainstorming. I don't evaluate. I don't say this is good, this is bad, this is, you know, nothing. I just write. And it frees you up. You just take your keyboard and start typing into the keyboard. You take a pencil. I do it with a pencil. I'm, you know, a little old-fashioned that way. Somehow when I take a pencil or a pen in my hand and a piece of paper, it just, everything starts flowing, and I don't stop. I just write until I'm finished, and then I'll go back and look at it and say, did I show who I was? You know, mm-hmm. did I tell a story? Would someone want to read this story? Would I want to read the story if I could step outside myself, which is hard to do, but if I step outside myself and read it, does it engage me? Would I say, wow, I want to know this person better, or I like this person, or I think this is a good person. Everything they've shared is very, very important. And again, it has to be my voice. It can't be someone else's. It has to be me talking about my journey, so to speak, if that's what I'm writing about, or some, turning points in my life, things that have happened to me that I think make a difference in who I am and might very well make a difference to the person that is reading. And don't make it too third person-ish. In other words, it shouldn't be about one can see that. You know, that's not how you write.
No, you're writing to one person. You're writing to the reader.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
I mean, one person
and
reading.
And almost imagine, what that reader would want to learn about you.
Right.
You know, and when I've worked with students in the past, I'm saying if you can't start just free writing, just make a bullet list of things about you.
Right.
And then just make a list. Just make a list, and then go back and look at it. And is there a story you could tell about one of those things? You know, if you think that, for example, that you were very tenacious, just to say in an essay, I'm a very tenacious person, is not
Boring.
Going to make a difference. You know,
Boring.
What makes you that way? You know, what about you is, what have you done that shows that? It's kind of a behavioral approach, rather than just putting in a list of adjectives. You know, and I see that very often students do that.
It is a behavioral approach, and it also is one that generally avoids arrogance, because instead of making claims about yourself, you're telling stories that reveal the qualities and the attributes you want the school to know about you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
absolutely, yeah.
It's an evidence-based approach.
I recently had someone that I was working with who was writing down, adjectives all over the place,
mm-hmm.
and has to tell me a story about it.
Sure.
Tell me about that. If you learned from some early challenges that you faced in your undergraduate degree, which a lot of students face those, don't just tell me it made you very tenacious and hardworking. I want to hear examples. What did you do? You know, how were you tenacious? How did I, tell me a story. Tell me a little narrative about how it happened. And then you can use the adjective, but you know what? By the time you tell the story, you won't need to.
Right.
You draw the reader right to that conclusion without your having to say it.
It's absolutely true. Absolutely
so,
true. Now, how would you recommend that applicants choose recommenders in general? I realize that, as I've said it before, I'll say it again, graduate admissions is an extraordinarily broad field. So obviously there might be some different criteria, but I think there are some criteria that are true across the board.
Yes, absolutely. You want to make sure that the person you ask to serve as a recommender is truly and completely willing to do so.
Right.
What I've had in the past, or even students who have come to me and said, would you write, when I was the dean of graduate admissions, which if it was for my school, it was a little bit uncomfortable. I said, no, I don't think I really should do that. But they would ask me after having been a student in my class one semester, and they did all right. All right? Right there, they shouldn't have asked me. And I would actually come out and tell them, I don't think that you want me to serve as a recommender for you because I don't know you well enough to be able to do so.
Hmm.
If they were smart, they picked up on that. That meant I didn't have anything extraordinary to say about them.
Right.
All right? Because in many cases, I didn't know enough about them. But I used to, think to myself, what could I say? They were punctual? I don't
they showed up to class.
They showed up to every class. Well, isn't that wonderful? I mean, if that's all I say, that's like the subtext to the message. Anyone who would read that would say, oh, God, we don't want that student. Because they would know that what I was saying was, a way of trying not to say they were okay student,
Yeah.
You want to make sure that the person that you ask is happy to, willing to, and knows you well enough to be able to. In other words, you want to ask somebody who's going to tell an admissions committee that this person would be an extraordinary asset to your graduate program, that this person ranks up in maybe the top 5% of every student I've had over the years. Those are things that will make a difference to an admissions committee. So you want to choose people who know you well, that, of course, you know, have that you have a relationship with, that you've spent time with in a classroom setting, that can speak for the most part to your academics. And it's there's nothing wrong with also helping that person to write that recommendation.
That was actually going to be my next question. Giving them additional information, your resume,
And
maybe reminding them of some of the more impressive achievements that you've had, that's one thing. But what about the really common situation where a professor who's known you well says, yes, he is willing to write a letter of recommendation? Well, this is a problem. He's very enthusiastic about your candidacy, and he says, you write it, I'll sign it. Now, I know MBA programs, the top ones, hate that. Absolutely hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, so you have kind of within academia, you have the admissions offices, or certainly a certain percentage of them, saying, that's horrible. How can you do that? And mm-hmm. you have professors saying, you write it, I'll sign it. And the students really don't want to write it.
That's a difficult situation because very often their voice comes through.
Right.
And so that an admissions committee is going to know that it's not them that it's not the professor speaking. And I understand that because sometimes you can be, as a professor, I was often inundated with requests for letters. And it's a lot of work. I mean, if you do it right, it's a lot of work to write a letter of recommendation.
Right.
Because you have to say more than just, this was a good student and I would recommend them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want to hear more than that. They want a full letter. And I have seen letters that were written, as a matter of fact, by some of my colleagues in the speech-language pathology department who wrote letters for students who were going elsewhere. And in some cases, they wrote them for students who were going to Hofstra for that, you know, applying to Hofstra for that program. They were extraordinary letters. They were personal. You knew that they knew this student and that they really could attest to their academics, to their community service, to all kinds of really very positive things. So I really don't know how a student should handle that, but I would try to find a professor who wouldn't do that.
Okay.
Me to write it myself.
I think it's a very tough place for the applicants to be. And again, you do have this dichotomy within academia where admissions officers are saying, no, don't do that. And professors are saying,
I can't be bothered. I don't want to write it. Yes, yeah. Well, you know what? What they could do, I think that there's a kind of a middle ground. If they provide the professor with some talking points and say, I can do this if you can just write the letter around these particular talking points, I think that's the better course of action.
Mm-hmm.
So, give them the ideas about what they could talk about and then see if they're willing to write the letter themselves in their own voice. So that's a possibility, you know, as long as it sounds like it's coming from them and not, you know, being written, by the student themselves. I have actually in my prior employments over the years had, an administrator ask me to write it, and I was very uncomfortable. They said, well, I'll write you a letter of recommendation. You write it and then I'll sign it. I was not comfortable with that. And so I did that. I took the other road and said, how about if I just give you some talking points or my resume, my CV, so you can see everything I've done. And then, you know, feel free to choose whichever ones you think would, make a difference. And they were okay with it. They weren't thrilled, but they were okay with it.
Okay. One of the difference I think that I've seen, certainly since I started Accept It, is a more active role for parents in graduate admissions. And most parents that I come across, they really just want to help their kids, and they're doing it in what I view as an appropriate way. There are, of course, some parents that are not behaving so appropriately. What do you feel is the appropriate role for parents of young adults in their 20s applying to graduate school?
I think that having been there myself, having three children and gone through that, I think that that most parents have the best instincts, and I can understand how they feel. So even at times when I've spoken to parents, I'll tell them, I know how you feel. I've been there. I've done it myself. And I know that you know, we spend our entire lives trying to put Band-Aids on the boo-boo for our children.
Right.
And sometimes it's hard to step away from that and let them, even as graduate students, do it on their own. I think the best way for parents to handle that is to be there as a sounding board and a support,
mm-hmm.
and not to give students their answers. And I'll tell you just a little story about one thing that happened to me once when I had a student who was accepted. We had an open house. The parent came to the open house, not the student. He said, well, I'll fill out the application and I'll hand it in for my daughter. And I said, please don't do that. Your daughter needs to fill out the application herself. I don't think he listened, but, you know, there was an application that came through. I'm not quite sure it was hers. She was accepted to the program. I think it was a program in special education and a master's program in special education. And it came time for her to get advised, and we had a big advisement session, and I was there, among others, doing advisement. And he came with her, and he sat down at the table with me, and she sat slightly behind him, and he said, here is what I want my daughter to take her first semester.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I looked at the courses, and I looked at him, and I said very politely, and what would your daughter like to take? He said, this is what I need her to take. I want her to take these classes. I said, I understand your needs. I respect your needs. But I need to talk to your daughter. I said, because she's the one that's taking the classes. And I'm the one who has the expertise to advise her about the appropriate classes so she can get through the program in the 2 years that's being offered. And he said, he started sputtering all over the place, and he said, I said to him, sir, I don't think you want to be responsible for the fact that your daughter won't graduate in a timely fashion, do you? And he said, no, I don't. I said, well, if she follows your advice, she will not graduate in a timely fashion. So please let me help her. And you sit there and be the wonderful dad you are and just support her in her endeavors. I actually shut him down. I was very polite. I told him I understood how he felt, which I did. I could relate to that, you know.
Yeah.
And he did step down. But the truth of it was he was putting her in classes that were not appropriate.
That
you know, and he finally, I finally got through to him when I said, are you going to be responsible for her not graduating in a timely fashion? And that got through. I said, if you want to be responsible for that, then I won't help her. Then she'll have to go online and register herself.
We had a situation, again, most of the parents that we encounter are really just trying to help their kids. And I also
yes,
have
they are.
Children. But we've had occasions like the one you described where the parents were actually harming their child.
Yes.
So, for example, I think the one stands out in my mind is somebody inquired about essay editing, and I don't even think I realized it initially. I think, or maybe I did realize it was a father, maybe I didn't. And sent the essay to a consultant for an estimate review, you know, a first opinion. And he said, this thing just is not salvageable. And I was like, huh, is that bad? And I went and I looked at it, and he was right. It was awful. It was terrible. The English was just awful. And then later on, I was just reviewing some work, and they worked out what we were supposed to do and proceeded. And later on, I was reviewing the work, and I saw another draft, and the essay was really, it was okay. You know, English was reasonable. The structure was reasonable. And so I called up the consultant. I said, what happened with that first essay? And he said, well, the dad wrote it.
Oh.
And the dad had never studied English formally. So, A, he knew nothing about admissions for the particular area that the son was interested in, and B, he didn't know how to write in English. I'm sure he knew how to write in his native language, but he did not know how to write in English. So the writing was really, really awful. If you know, again, somebody applying to graduate school has gone to college here. He has university-level language.
Right.
And clearly the father did not, nor would I have expected him to if I knew it was his. But if he was masquerading as his son, then there's a whole different set of expectation. Obviously, there's other issues involved in the story, too. But in this case, the bottom line, much like the story that you were telling, is that the father, by trying to take charge, was actually hurting, potentially going to hurt his son's chances of acceptance. And in the end, he backed out. The son wrote it. And if I remember correctly,
I think most parents do. I think that they, you know, but they're very few, and this the gentleman that I'm telling you about was very controlling, you know, just felt that he knew everything and that he could help his child best. And, you know, and I understand that, you know, again, because we spend all of our lives, you know, protecting and taking care of and making sure that everything works well and we want everything to be perfect for our children. But, you know, sometimes you do them a disservice by doing that. And, you know, even for undergraduate students, when they're applying, I think a lot of parents do them a disservice there, too, because they start writing the essays.
Absolutely.
And their children allow it, you know. And, you know, actually, when my own children were going to college, I refused. I said, I'll look at it. I'll give you some advice.
Yeah, me too.
You'll write this yourself. You need to write this yourself. Because the school will know if it isn't you.
Right, right.
You know, no, so it happens. Yeah, I think most parents really, their heart is in it. And I think if you speak to them rationally and let them know that you really understand what they're feeling, which I did, they will step away. If some takes a little bit longer to step away than others, though.
That's true.
I have to push away, a little bit more pushing.
Right, right. I think that, you know, the parents have to realize that it's the child's task at that point to write the essay to get into graduate school, to succeed in graduate school. The parent can maybe get information or something for them if they want to help them out. And they can obviously pay for it if they want to really help them out. But they can't actually do the work for them.
No, certainly not.
Right. Well, Carol, this has really been wonderful. I'm sure you and I could continue talking about these topics for a lot longer, but it's time to bring this to a close. I'm going to link to your bio and to your blog posts from the show notes at info.exip.com/113. And again, I really want to thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks so much. I've enjoyed it.
Listener, thank you, too, for joining Carol Drummer and me for our 113th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, I have a favor to ask. Please share the good word by leaving a review on iTunes. Your doing so helps us spread the word about Admissions Straight Talk, especially if you leave a shiny 5-star feedback. So if you think AST deserves those 5 stars, please let iTunes know. There's a link in the show notes to our iTunes page where you can leave a review with however many stars you want. I would also like to thank 2 reviewers and share the reviews they left. First, to a thank you, big thank you to Mom of Loads, who left a 5-star review and wrote, "Golden MBA advice. Admissions Straight Talk is and has always been a great listen and a wellspring of information. This week's podcast, June 11th, was amazing, and I found myself listening to it twice so that I could jot down some of the notes provided by the guest, a former MBA admissions committee member. Esmeralda was so real, down to earth, and gave practical advice for future MBA applicants. Listening to her made you feel like she was rooting for you to succeed. Keep up the great work." Well, thank you very much, Mom of Loads. And then thanks also to, he gave a very complicated pseudonym, EDDF, and a bunch of numbers, from Argentina, who gave a 4-star review and wrote, "Great podcast. Really enjoy all the insight provided for MBA admissions. Not so interested in the other topics, so I generally delete those." Thanks to both of you. I really appreciate both reviews, and I certainly understand about deleting something that you're not interested in. I do that on the podcast that I listen to also. Finally, if you have a Question for me, please ask it at info.accepted.com/113 or by sending an email to questions@accepted.com. Thanks again for coming. This is Admissions Trade Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.